Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Deadly domestic violence cases are searing the headlines in the DMV. Just last week, 29-year-old Remy Howell found shot multiple times and her body left in a wooded area near a church in Landover. Marcus Mitchell, a man she dated, charged with her murder. On February 5th, just a few days before, 32-year-old Passion Pleasant of Northeast D.C. found shot multiple times and stabbed on I-295. Her boyfriend, 30-year-old Gregory Johnson, also charged with her murder. What's going on? What triggers a perpetrator of domestic violence to this extreme? We are talking about it with Dr. Paulette Hubbard tonight, licensed clinical social worker. Also with us, Neil Irvin, executive director of Men Can Stop Rape, and Queen Afi, founder of Domestic Violence Wears Many Tags. If you have a comment, if you have a question, if you need help or resources, give us a call right now. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Thank you all for joining the conversation. Let me get right to this. Dr. Hubbard, that question that I asked, what prompts the perpetrator of domestic violence to a deadly extreme?
Hi, Harold. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me?
Okay, awesome. Yes, I can.
Please go right. Did you hear my question?
Yes. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Sure.
There are several things that can prompt a perpetrator. One, we know that it takes a victim on average up to 7 to 8 times to leave a domestic violence relationship permanently. We also know that we've known for years that the most dangerous time for a victim to try and leave, or the most dangerous time for a victim is when they're trying to leave a situation. And it's most dangerous because it's at that point that the perpetrator feels that they've lost control of the situation and of that person. And so they then become violent. And sometimes they take on the attitude that if you're not going to be with me, then you're not going to be with anyone.
Why that ownership, that inappropriate thought process for someone that you are supposed to love?
Well, that's part of the entire problem with domestic violence and the perpetrator. The perpetrator uses power and control in order to hold on and manage that victim. They also use other tactics in regards to isolating. There may also, when we talk about domestic violence, it's not just physical abuse. There's sometimes psychological aggression that happens, emotional abuse, financial abuse. There are a lot of different tactics that they use to control them and manipulate that individual. And for most perpetrators, they see that as love because that's typically the only thing that they've experienced as love. And there are other societal factors that may also go into that. Even for victims, they sometimes don't see themselves as victims because they've been desensitized to the violence. As such, the perpetrator, they don't necessarily see it as a form of violence. They see it as a way of showing their love or being able to maintain control of not only that person but their household.
Queen, there were reports after the murder of Passion Pleasant. Her family said that she was attempting to get out of the relationship with her boyfriend for some time. Talk to me about why so many women do not have an exit plan or feel that they may be helpless to leave a relationship that is no longer safe.
Yes, Queen Afi, thank you for letting me chime in tonight.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Of course, you know I was the abuser, so you victims are psychologically in isolation. You know, they don't get to think for themselves, they don't get to feel for themselves. The abuser comes in and takes over psychological control over this person's mind. So thinking about a plan, I'm not thinking about a plan. I'm thinking about how I can make my family work.
Hmm.
how I can make this abuse stop, how I can make my abuser go back to that, you know, to the first initial encounter when I fell in love with him or her. Victims don't think about a plan. We don't, they just don't think that far out when they're in it so deep like that. And passion was in it deep. The abuser was able to lure her back into his vehicle after she said that, I don't want to be with you no more. And victims tell the abuser that, oh, I don't want to be with you no more. It's over. Victims do not need to do that because it's dangerous. It's going to put you in a bracket of being killed. And this guy was telling Passion, you can't leave me, basically. Don't leave me. And now she's dead. The abuser know every place the victim is going to be at. I know what time she get up in the morning. I know when she comes to the bus stop. I know what Uber she getting. I know where she working. I know where she taking the children at. How in the world is the victim going to escape? Where does she think she going at?
If, and, you know, obviously you are familiar, you know, with, you know, with Passion and her family. What, if anything, would you perhaps recommend? I mean, do you recommend the police? Do you recommend asking, you know, family to help? Because, again, based on the reporting that we have seen, her family was aware that she was trying to get away.
Passion, and I've had several people reach out to me, her coworkers and everything, saying that she was trying to get out. You cannot give no signs of exiting the relationship. You have to do everything in secret. You have to work with someone in secret to do this because the plan is to never come back. The plan is to never return once it gets this bad. That's one exit strategy. And the exit strategy that Passion was trying to take, she was trying to go through the court system. But, of course, the system was not, you know, holding him accountable like they should have been in the beginning when you had other women that were pressing charges on this guy. His ankle monitor was linked to where she was located at. Like, how is this?
Queen Afif, founder of Domestic Violence Wears Many Tags. Thank you so much for your insight and your passion regarding this.
Absolutely.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about deadly domestic violence. Why is this happening? How can people who are afraid of a domestic violent situation, how can they protect themselves? If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. Neil Irvin, let's talk about this from the perspective of the perpetrator. You know, your thoughts about what we're seeing right now in the headlines, where these cases are once again, you know, on the rise. We know that women also can be perpetrators, but the lion's share, obviously, of deadly domestic violence is men.
I think that's exactly right, and I want to support both Dr. Hubbard and Queen's comments that, you know, for us at Men Can Stop Rape now in our 25th year of service, you know, our focus is really about how we teach men to see ourselves as individuals who can be strong without being violent, how we can gain a skill set connected to our social emotional intelligence so that the management of frustration, anger, fear, this need to control others, that is not a part of how we identify as men. So that what we want to do is include more men to work with these violent men so that we can try to create communities and environments where they are held accountable and that they are not able to go on for sometimes years harming so-called loved ones to the point where it ends up in a murder. So for us, the important piece is really starting young with primary prevention, teaching boys a better way of how they can identify as men, and hopefully continue to give them doses throughout their developmental stages. And then with adult men, really lifting up, it truly does take a village in holding men accountable. And this is not being anti-male, but as you said, the lion's share of that level of violence is perpetrated by men, even as most of us will never do it. So we feel like it's important that if we don't engage men sooner in their childhood, and then throughout their lifetime, unfortunately, 25 years later, we're still seeing men trying to control under the guise of love, loving their family. And yet, ultimately, we know that that's not really the type of love we want to see.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about deadly domestic violence incidents in the DMV. High-profile cases really shocking us all. Let's talk a little bit about this with Robert. Robert, calling from Fort Washington. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Appreciate. It's obvious if you listen to the actual individuals that spoke on it before. You're trying to address an inside problem with an outside source. You have to realize they're saying that there's men who are the perpetrators, but we don't understand oneness. It's obviously when two come together as one. That's a relationship. It doesn't take for them to get a piece of paper from the system to say that they're married. They're one, and that's relationship. So when you tell someone you love them, you have to understand what you're saying. That's the worst lie you can ever tell. And if you don't understand it, when you say you love somebody, that's attacking their spiritual heart. So to lose your heart because you're one with each other, I can understand it. I don't condone it. But to say the males are the perpetrators, males are the ones that are seen to actually do the most killing. I guarantee you they're not giving the number of the females. And it's not, I'm not trying to say this is oneness. But the bottom line to it is, it's leadership. Because this man just said it takes a village. Who is the head of the village? God designed the church to be the head of the village.
So, Robert, let me stop you because right now it sounds to me like you were defending the perpetrators of this crime.
I never said that.
I'm telling you what it sounds like.
Okay, what it sounds like, and I can.
So I want you to hold on. I'm going to give you an opportunity to back this up and clarify your point, because when it comes to statistics and things like that, are law enforcement agencies that do compile statistics regarding this. And as Neil said, and we know historically, and even if you don't even talk about long past history, just look at the most recent deadly domestic violence cases in this area. The last two perpetrated by men. As I said, not always perpetrated by men, but even the last two, the most high-profile cases perpetrated by men. And these are not, you can call them relationships, but the bottom line is that these quote-unquote relationships has ended up with women dead. So I'll let you make your point, and then I'm going to move on. Go ahead.
Okay, right. So, and I'll make it quick to you. First of all, I said that there men are the cause of it, prospectively, what is being said. And you're speaking on statistics by the law enforcement agencies who we're dealing with now. See, one, I'll end this real quick. It's not about men. It's not about women. Who's doing it the most? It's a problem with who's doing it, because the individuals who are making choices to pick the individuals that are doing it to them are making bad choices. So we need education on that.
Okay. Well, let me stop you there. So thank you so much for your phone call. So Dr. Hubbard, I need you to try to dissect what Robert was just saying. I think that last point, which is something that we will have to drill down a little bit more about, choices, red flags in relationships. And I do agree with his point. There are things that we must look at. But your thoughts about what he was sharing with us.
Harold, I hate to say this, but I was having difficulty hearing him. It was breaking up. He was breaking up.
Okay. Neil,
can
did you
summarize what he said?
He said a lot. Neil, did you hear what he said?
Sure. I did. And where I would say is I would look at the pattern as you were trying to share with him. We're not being anti-male by being honest about where the majority of this violence comes from. And for those of us, like the National Network to End Domestic Violence based here in Washington, D.C., the D.C. Rape Crisis Center, and many other service agencies that try to work with families experiencing domestic violence, whether it be from a mental health perspective, a medical perspective, a legal perspective, What we look at is the science and the data that supports that overwhelmingly when this violence to this level of lethality occurs, it's men doing it. And what your caller missed me saying was most of us as men are not killing our partners, our wives, our girlfriends, our boyfriends, our partners. We're not doing that. So we're trying to invite those men in to be a resource to create healthier environments. But if we start with just the spiritual connection of our humanity, we're ignoring the fact that women and children and others are, as we speak, experiencing domestic violence in our city now. And that can't be spiritual because it's tangible.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the importance of trying to intervene in this work is indeed about a community and a network and a continuum of care that holds perpetrators of violence accountable. And we have to be honest with what we're saying. That's overwhelmingly men perpetrating it. Even if men experience this domestic violence, the majority of time when same-sex relationships are, it's men doing it to other men. So we've got to be honest about these things and recognize that being honest doesn't mean we're being anti-male. And we cannot just put God in the forefront when people's lives are at risk.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about deadly domestic violence, searing the headlines here in the DMV. I need to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk to Dr. Tricia on the line. Also, Brandon calling from Southeast D.C. So please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. Also coming up on 96.3 HD2. Don't forget to download the app on your phone so that you can hear the broadcast in its entirety. Also, 98.3 FM. Stay with us. Stretches in for John Mons with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back with this conversation in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we are examining deadly domestic violence, some high-profile, horrific cases in the DMV and beyond. My guests are Dr. Paulette Hubbard, a licensed clinical social worker, and Neil Irvin, executive director of Men Can Stop Rape. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Tricia calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
It's really, I'm excited to be able to have this conversation. I think what I just heard from the previous caller was of us having this conversation in our community. It is vital that we are having this very conversation in our barbershops, in our salons, in our schools, in our faith-based communities, because it's growing the awareness around what domestic violence is, around what high-risk domestic violence is, that's going to help us to really change the culture and the dialogue around domestic violence. So I think just his comments, you know, are exactly part of the reason why these discussions are so critical.
Yeah, I agree. Even in my attempting to give him an opportunity to reconsider what he was saying, made it clear to me that he just did not understand.
Yeah, because I think that when we are having these conversations, oftentimes in our community, people tend to get frustrated, they get upset, and then they kind of walk away from the conversation. That's when we really need to dig in even more. He even brought up the conversation of spirituality and the faith-based community. Again, this is a place where we need to be having these conversations. And when they get to the point where they feel uncomfortable, that's when hopefully the growth will happen if we can just stick in there and continue to discuss this. In terms of the statistics, we know, for example, Black women are 3 times more likely than white women to be killed by their intimate partner. I mean, that is the fact of it. I mean, we see that in all of the data that's been collected for many, many years. Unfortunately, that's not something that's new. It's been occurring for many years. And I think part of the reason why is because we oftentimes are not having this conversation. It delays our help seeking. And by the time we do reach out to people, we are in such a severe state of risk that it really does put us in a place where the violence can become lethal.
If we then turn to our friends and family and they don't know what it is or they have judgment around it, it makes it even harder to reach out for help. So there's a reason that we're seeing these numbers, and I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah. Of course, this is Dr. Tricia Brent-Goodley. She is a professor emeritus at Howard University School of Social Work. Dr. Hubbard, you've had an opportunity, I would imagine, to talk to men who have been perpetrators of domestic violence.
Yes.
Yeah. What do they say? You know, once they are on your couch, your sofa, as it were, your counseling couch.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yes,
that.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. What do they say about why they would put their hands on their partner instead of having other kinds of emotional resources to deal with conflict or the possibility of separation or from that partner?
They often normalize violence as an aspect of showing their love in terms of being able to be the man of the house and to control, as we know, though, it's power and control, but they often normalize their violence. For some, it's a way of strictly controlling their partner, be it male or female, controlling their partner in a way that they feel, how do I pull it, they feel as a man. So in other words, they oftentimes have low self-esteem. They haven't had the opportunities to engage or even or witness real relationships or what relationships should look like. There's often not mutual respect in the relationships. That's lacking. In addition to coping skills, not having the appropriate coping skills and conflict resolution skills in order to manage differences of opinions or manage whatever experiences may come up where there are differences of opinion or that they feel that they need to exert their power and their influence over their loved ones. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes they don't see it as, or they see it as an aspect of love. They don't see it as that there's anything wrong with it.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Brandon, calling from Southeast D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm listening to everyone, and I'm hearing the story about, you know, this so drastic domestic violence that we are going through in our community. First of all, you know, we come from broken homes, you know. And the broken homes started at, you know, from a mother or, you know, the father being in the home, you know, from a boyfriend. And you see them hitting, cussing, smoking, drinking, you know, and they're being around a child. So the child grows with it. Okay. So when the child get at an age, like teenagers start experimenting with boys or boys experimenting with girls, they thinking hitting is okay. So it gets, you know, it gets very, very out of hand, okay, to go to parties. You know, you talk to someone else. You're not married, but your girlfriend's your boyfriend. You know, you grab them, okay? They think that's okay. You know, say, oh, he loved me. He, you know, he protected me. But all the time, he putting hands on you. So this has...
Oh, my goodness.
It's okay to grab a woman. You know, it's okay to smack a woman. Because our communities have been broken. You know, the values and morals have been taken out of our community. Like they say, they want programs for it, but the program starts at home. If your home is broken, how can you, you know, grab something like love? Love ain't even in the picture on them.
Yeah.
You know, because you ain't seeing love.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your input. Neil, does he make a point?
Well, I think he does, as does Dr. Brent-Goodley as well. I mean, you know, these are longstanding problems that don't happen in just an overnight moment, that these are patterns of behavior, lifelong trauma, both for survivors and perpetrators, that manifest in all sorts of ways in terms of unhealthy and destructive behavior, and then normalizing violence is something that we've heard a couple of times as well. So I think very accurate. You know, I think that's why primary prevention with young people is so important, so that they can understand what are the characteristics of a healthy relationship, how do you end a relationship healthy and supportive and safe. And I think if that doesn't happen, we find ourselves in circumstances and situations where women are finding themselves injured or killed. So I think it does, again, you know, require us to do, you know, a lot of work on the primary prevention side. So we're teaching boys and men to understand what who they are as individuals, how to understand their emotions, how to manage their emotions, to de-escalate themselves and others when violence is around, so that if they do find themselves in relationships, they know how to manage it so that it is pro-social and productive and loving and caring and not about control and power and dominance, and that you don't allow yourself to get caught up into owning someone or owning the relationship as a piece of property. And so, again, you know, the violence that leads to murder is at the extreme end, but there are all sorts of subtle signs and moments throughout any person's development that could start to establish and normalize accepting violence as a way to communicate pain or hurt or fear.
When you're the guides, the navigators, the men in your organization who have an opportunity to sit down with the perpetrators of domestic violence, what are they hearing? What are they hearing from these perpetrators? Is it similar to what Dr. Hubbard was saying? Give us some insight.
Absolutely. I mean, all sorts of insecurities in their ego, and they're connecting and misconnecting, you know, or interpreting, you know, possession and ownership rather than building a life together or showing genuine care or love, and that they have somehow been disrespected or affronted, or that I'm the man, and so therefore it's just kind of written that that's how things should be and that I should have ultimate authority. So I think you hear a whole continuum of behaviors that are both the perpetrator's own trauma, being abused or neglected themselves, not to make excuses, but to speak to how trauma may manifest throughout your life. Substance abuse, addictions, drugs, and alcohol, it was mentioned. So I think you see all sorts of antisocial and self-destructive behavior over the course of anyone's lifetime, and that trauma can show up and manifest in all sorts of ways. And for many men who are perpetrating domestic violence, many of them believe that what they are doing is their right, and that that they are expressing love, and that that the perpetrator has brought this violence upon themselves. Or I heard earlier Dr. Hubbard say they're about to lose control of their relationship. It's about to be exposed that they're not the good person that everyone in the community may think they are. And so they go to the extremes of trying to silence the person who may be able to expose that they are not, you know, the man that they want everyone to believe they are. So you really hear a range of what these men are experiencing and what they believe when they perpetrate. And it's for us to always constantly hold them accountable by really pointing out how unhealthy their belief systems are, to try to give them skills and new ways of thinking, to practice, to understand a better, healthier way, not only for themselves, but for people they want to be in relationships with, because it is so vast how people find themselves at this end of violence that we would never say there's just one way to get there. But faith communities are really important. Barbershops are really important. Your school peers, your family, anyone who can be a listener and then offer you some insights and some skills to develop a better way of interacting with people is what we really try to promote. And these are the things that our facilitators and our trainers work to do with men and boys all over the country.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Monique, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, Monique. What's on your mind? Monique, are you there?
Unique, I'm still here.
Yeah, go right ahead. What's on your mind?
So I was basically saying that, you know, I don't feel like Maryland or D.C. give you help in a situation like this. I've been someone who dealt with domestic violence over 3 to 5 years now. I had to do everything on my own. I mean, it was no support in my situation. I'm still dealing with it ongoing right now. I've known people who reached out to me for how did I get to where I'm at right now, and one is dead now, and one is still fighting for her life. So I'm just basically saying that, you know, it's no resources really out here for domestic violence. I mean, they give you phone lines and people that you can call and safe programs, but that doesn't help you. And I'm one of the ones that didn't get any help.
Can I offer up just briefly?
Sure.
I so appreciate this sister for sharing, because what I really hear is, for the length of time, and Dr. Hubbard, I'm sure you know, and I know if Dr. Sure. Ben Goodley is still here, the District Alliance for Safe Housing is a resource. My sister's place in mm-hmm. the city is a resource, and you may be familiar with them, sister, but I just want to give you that is just another resource, and I
this is a place I called them too. I reached out to all, everything you could name, I've done it.
I believe you. I believe you. And I think it really points out, Harold, that there's just not enough. We need more resources for not only more programming, but more recovery, more career training, more bed, male shelters. There's not enough. When we're spending millions of dollars on all sorts of other entities or resources, there is not enough money going into the gender-based violence, sexual assault, domestic violence field. This sister's calling up. Thank you so much again for your leadership, because you find people in these circumstances, women in these circumstances, and particularly women of color, black women, and there's just not enough there for them. So I just really appreciate you bringing that point up, because,
many
of our colleagues
and I wonder why she's willing to speak no matter.
Are overwhelmed with the amount of calls and caseloads that they get. They're working hard trying to support these survivors, but there's just not enough resources, and we need more.
Before I go to Dr. Hubbard about this, Unique, are you still there?
Yeah.
You said that there aren't enough resources.
No.
But what specifically would you like to see? I mean, we can have more, but I think what may be more important is not just to have more choices, but specific kinds of choices and resources. What would you recommend? What would you want the resources to do that, in your opinion, they have not been able to do?
Rather than putting someone in a safe program, I'd rather that you put someone in a situation where they're able to contact someone that's able to help them in a situation like this. As well as, I mean, I've reached out to many resources and things like that. They did not help and they didn't want to help because they felt like it was like burden on their behalf. But like I'm telling them, you got to think, like I said, I lost two people to this, domestic violence, and myself is one of the ones who's still fighting it. So what I would say, just more resources in the process of just basically handing them out, seeking them places, and not just safe programs. Safe programs is only 2 weeks, more to a month, and then you back at where you started out from. Mm. They're not finding you home for real. They're not relocating you for real. So you're still dealing with this abuser. And that's what I've dealt with, and I'm still dealing with that, and this person has found me.
Dr. Hubbard, your thoughts about what
Have you reached out to the National Domestic Violence Hotline? Have you reached out to them?
Maryland and D.C., yes, I did. Yes, I did. And no help on neither behalf.
And from the National?
And she said, no, go ahead, Dr. Hubbard.
Yes, National. I'm in the process now. I have to relocate again.
So help me with this, Neil, because I think this is, for those of us on the outside looking in who are not, familiar with the trauma and the horror of domestic violence, that can, what part do you believe law enforcement can play? We've seen over decades, and heard the term, paper shield, where people have restraining orders and the like. But those things are not as helpful as we would want. So, Neil, your thoughts about what role perhaps law enforcement may need to play in this, because we do want the uniques of our community to be protected and not to have to deal with this on her own.
Yeah, absolutely. I think first responders, whether it be EMTs or law enforcement, first and foremost, it's more training to better understand the best way from a trauma-informed approach, understanding what survivors may be going through, but also understanding what perpetrators may be doing in an attempt to de-escalate and try to find a safety for the victim in these circumstances. Unique, I would really encourage you, I know this is a difficult challenge, to continue calling our local resources. Again, the District Alliance for Safe Housing certainly could provide you some guidance, along with the D.C. Domestic Violence Coalition, could absolutely try to provide you some resources, some guidance to assist you. Everyone is so full right now, capacity drained. But when it comes to law enforcement, you know, it wasn't that long ago where police officers would show up and say, hey, tell the man just to walk around the block, you know, calm down, and would leave the victim in the home. Now, unfortunately, there are still situations that aren't too far from that, but we do have with our MPD and other groups, there are trainings happening with law enforcement, not only in D.C., but around the country, to better prepare them in knowing what resources exist so survivors aren't going through what Unique is going through, to understand, like, what shelter care is there, what additional resources may be needed. And then, again, it can't just be the police. We can't lock up everybody. It can't just be the EMTs. Everybody can't go to the hospital. It really is a continuum of care that all of the service providers of the city do their role, whether it be mental health, medical treatment, law enforcement, primary prevention, in our schools, in our faith communities. Everyone needs to, not just once a week or Harold, when you have this great show, every day, we all have a responsibility to do something towards creating safer, healthier environments for everyone, so sisters like Unique are not finding themselves so vulnerable, so frustrated, and so unclear of how to get help when they are reaching out for it. Because I think that becomes the challenge when we put everything on law enforcement thinking that they're going to be the fix. It's a setup for them because that's not their role. Their role is to de-escalate violence, to prevent violence, hold accountable anyone who's committing crimes, particularly in this case around domestic violence, to try to prevent the lethality from occurring. So, again, I think the primary prevention is always an answer, but in the midst of what Unique is going through, we have some great service organizations here in D.C. that are really trying to provide as much resource and as much support for survivors of domestic violence. Anyone in the audience tonight, they can definitely call the National Domestic Violence Hotline. They definitely call the National Network to End Domestic Violence. Definitely have the D.C. Alliance for Safe Housing and My Sister's Place. Together, collectively, I'm confident saying this, that any of those entities will try to find some way to continue helping Unique and other colleagues, or excuse me, other neighbors who are going through this. So we're not leaving it on just the burden on just one organization, but trying to spread and all play a role towards correcting this really, really horrible scourge that's going on. And again, coming out of this COVID, the increase in this violence, people's anxiety, people's mental health, unemployment, all the things that are kind of manifesting are making those people who are not themselves in their best, I'm not trying to say just it's mental health, but they themselves now are exacerbating. Things are escalating in their lives. So it's making everyone far more vulnerable to violence when we're not all working together as a community.
Unique, thank you so much.
Harold, I don't...
Go ahead, Dr. Hubbard. Go ahead.
Can I also add that to add into law enforcement resources, I would really like to see victim advocates out and working with those violence when victims of domestic violence are identified. It is so important, even at that time that the domestic violence is occurring and law enforcement is working to de-escalate, there should be a victim advocate on site helping that victim to safety plan. Mm-hmm. That safety planning is imperative for a victim, if that was happening, the things that Unique is talking about now in regard to her having to move again possibly wouldn't have happened had she had someone on the spot safety planning with her and going through that process. There's a process of safety planning that happens to help a victim, especially when they're in the crisis of the experience happening. Nobody's thinking straight. Emotions are running high. The victim is just thinking about trying to get away. And so having that victim advocate on the spot, helping that victim to not only calm and to manage her trauma while in the midst of it happening, that victim advocate is also familiar with what resources are available. They're typically connected with the courts that helps, that will help victims get into court faster to get that restraining order. I know that's just a piece of paper, but they're also knowledgeable on what shelters in the area are available if they, should the victim need to go to a shelter, and the other safety things that need to be put in place as a victim to ensure that they don't have the reoccurrence of the violence happening.
Unique, thank you for sharing your story with us, and please, please stay safe and continue to speak up and to speak out. We wish you only the best. Thank you so much for sharing with us. Dr. Hubbard, can an abuser find redemption and change his or her ways? And if so, how is that done?
Yes, they can. I've seen many successful transformations with perpetrators, for male and female perpetrators, but they first have to have the desire, and just like Neil just talked about in regard to coping skills and having coping skills and the ability to manage healthy relationships, learning and being forced. Sometimes when you see perpetrators, most of the time they're court ordered, so that's what I mean by being forced. But once they're in a program of such, them learning what a healthy relationship is, learning how to manage their emotions and their feelings and their reactions to conflict, learning conflict resolution, all of those things that fall in place under the umbrella of a healthy relationship, they can be transformed, but it takes work and commitment for them to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. You know, again, from the outside looking in, Neil, for those who are able to get away from abusive relationships, women, let's say, who are able to get away from abusive relationships, physically abusive, emotionally abusive, on the surface, some would say, well, you know, you just need to pick better men. But it's not that simple, is it?
No, I don't think it is. I think, you know, again, there are moments where people have, you know, a stereotypical belief about relationships that, you know, this is the husband of, or this is the father of my children, or this is, you know, my boyfriend. When the violence isn't there, he's a great father or provider. It's far more complicated than just, you know, someone walking away from an abuser. And I think that's where when people say, hey, why didn't she leave, or she could have just done that. I mean, there's so many complicated issues that go into the family dynamic that, as our callers were saying, you know, the perpetrator is intertwined in their lives, know where the kids go to school, know where they work. So it's just a very complicated, challenging thing. And I think all of us as a society have work to do in role modeling and teaching and learning ourselves. What is a healthy relationship? How do we end relationships in a healthy, nonviolent way? So that when we see these crisis versions or these escalating versions of unhealthy relationships, we all can play a role in trying to find a nonviolent, safe, and healthy solution, because it's a very complicated thing when you're dealing with people's emotions, you're dealing with people's psychological histories, you're dealing with people's traumatic histories, and then you find yourself in a relationship trying to communicate something that you may not really yourself even understand. So that doesn't excuse the violence ever. But it does try to offer some insights as to how complicated it is for those who are experiencing the violence to get away from it, and maybe speak a little bit to how those who are using violence to control are themselves probably acting out their own self-destructive or traumatic or, you know, neglected development as well.
Well, what I mean by that, and this is for both of you. For the sake of argument, let us say that the perpetrator and the victim are not intertwined with children. They are not married. They are just dating, and she gets out of it, and he eventually leaves her alone, and then she goes back into the dating pool, so to speak. What kinds of things should she look for, beware of? And how do you balance, okay, he says something because he's angry, but he, you know, how do you deal with Is he angry, but how he's dealing with this is a healthy way to deal with anger? Or do I think he's about to hit me?
Trauma breeds trauma. And so that individual, that victim that gets out of, and we often see this, or at least I often see this in the domestic violence arenas that I've worked with and working with domestic violence victims. They go from one abusive relationship to the next abusive relationship. And oftentimes you see patterns in that, and it's because trauma breeds trauma. Trauma breeds trauma, and oftentimes they're not aware of what a healthy relationship looks like, and they're not aware of the red flags. So somebody calling them 20 times a day and checking on them, they see that, especially early on in the relationship, they may see that as, oh, he's interested, or they're flattered by the attention that they're getting. Or if you have some perpetrators, they turn on the charm in the beginning of the relationship, and so then the person falls in love with them. And so oftentimes it's not that they want to leave the person because they truly love them. They want the violence to stop. And so that's where we oftentimes see the person. That's why we know statistically it takes 7 to 8 times on average for a victim, not all victims, but 7 to 8 times on average for a victim to leave a relationship, is because they truly love the individual. They just want the violence to stop, and that promise of the violence stopping is what causes them to go back that many times. And so when I work with females or even males that are coming out of abusive relationships, oftentimes there's low self-esteem, desperation for a relationship, that need or that want to be loved and to be validated. All of those things come into play, in addition to them not having coping skills and sometimes not being able to see or understand what those red flags mean.
Yeah. Dr. Paulette Hubbard, Neil Irvin, thank you both for talking to us. We also want to thank Queen Afi for joining the conversation. We appreciate all of your input. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, February 15th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.